History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there right around you that really need to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Fresno, California with 93-year-old Stan Filgus, a Navy veteran of World War II. You've been in Fresno a long time, Stan. I bet you've seen this place change a little bit.
Yes, it's changed a lot from what we did.
Well, and you grew up with a fairly big family. You had a brother who also served in World War II and three sisters. What was life like? What do you remember about those 1920s and 30s when you were growing up?
Well, we used to go to church and make ice cream after that. We kind of looked forward to Sunday. Not an exciting situation. We were just a family trying to make it through.
Do you remember the Depression years as being any different from the time before or after? Was that a tough time for your family or no?
I think it was a hard time for them, but I remember my dad was very strict with us. In fact, we were kind of scared of him.
Well, sometimes when you were in elementary school, you had to go work with your dad. Is that true?
Yeah, he had to go help him with the floors. My brother had to help too, same way. Young, 10 or 12. Nowadays, you can't get by with that. But my dad took all the help he could get, make a living.
What would you guys do?
Well, he scraped the edges of the hardwood and blended in. Scraping it gives it a certain texture, but when you blend it in, it all looks better. That's what we try to do.
And did the school ever notice that you were missing some time there because you're helping your dad?
Well, my brother got called on the carpet because of his absence. And my dad asked him, how are his grades? Well, he's straight A. Well, that was good enough for my dad.
I'm always curious what kind of ambitions someone had as a kid, because you don't know there's a war coming. I don't think you were dreaming, hey, someday I'm going to open up a carpet store with my brother. What were your dreams when you were a kid? What was that ambition you had?
I liked sports. Went to ball games and all that. They were important to me. We all tried to help each other through life.
And you played a little football for the Roosevelt Rough Riders. What position did you play?
I was a linebacker and a center. The reason I got to be a center and so small was a coach said, you get the ball going at the right time. And that was important.
How much did you weigh?
147. I had some bigger guys around me, but I really didn't think that was too bad. I held my own. I was fast, and I learned the plays. So I was supposed to be a lightweight, and the coach says, no, you're going to go up to the varsity when I was a junior. So that's what I did. I was a sprinter on top of that.
Leather helmets?
Leather helmets, yes. It was a lot of fun. We had a very good team. That's the first time we ever beat Fresno High. Spalding Wathan was the quarterback. He came from St. John's Catholic School as a senior transfer, and he was very good. We really got him. It was a real celebration. They didn't like getting beat, and it made a real rivalry. That's what I can remember about high school is football.
I want to ask you about something before that. So your birthday's in December, right?
December 7th, 12/7/25. That's my birthday.
Well, everybody seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941, but that was your 16th birthday, and the 16th birthday present wasn't exactly what you imagined. What do you remember about that day?
I remember that we were shooting squirrels at Academy. We were coming back, and the radio was on, and they talked about things burning, and what were they talking about? And then it said the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I says, oh, hell. And I had a Japanese kid with me, Frank Yamamura, and he says, oh, that will last 3 months. And he was wrong. And I did think he served, I think, maybe in Italy. Then I went to school. The teacher said to Franklin D. Roosevelt and all that, that there's a war with Japan. And the ag teacher says, you fellows are going to be in it, all of you will. So I said, what? Yep. So we had a fight.
Well, and you said, I mean, as this is unfolding, on that day, you're off squirrel hunting, and one of the guys with you hunting is a Japanese-American, your friend Frank. I'm sure he wasn't the only Japanese-American student you had at Roosevelt High, right?
They were there, and they had pride for their country.
Yeah, and I am always curious, because I didn't live through that. And it's kind of unique to this part of the country that there was a large Japanese-American population, first of all, and it was only those on the West Coast that got displaced and sent inland. So this was one of the places where that happened.
Frank was a good guy. I didn't care if he was Japanese or what, but he was a nice guy. As far as looking forward to how long the war would be, I didn't do that. I had to wait as it went along how long it would last.
Yeah, so how did that unfold that you ended up in the Navy?
The principal said that in spite of what you fellows think, we're not really winning this war yet, really. And he said the home front has now made ships, airplanes, and we need men now. And you're all in the senior class, you men are, and if you sign, get in there and give them help, we'll mail you a certificate, graduation. Yeah. So I said, I am going to fight for the country. And I meant it.
Well, you meant it. How did your parents feel about it? Because they would have to sign off on this idea if you're going to go in underage.
Of course, my mom, she was very protective. Mothers are. My dad says, oh, I signed for you. So he spoke broken English.
I didn't ask you about that part with your parents. Were they immigrants here?
They're from Czechoslovakia, Moravia. It's a really amazing story of how that all went. My dad, he had to go to a German camp. They wanted him to fight for Germany. And my dad says, I'm not going to fight for Germany. He balked. And he kept looking at the fence and some German guy says, don't look at that, shorty. He says, you ain't going no place. And my dad said to himself, you can't keep me forever. And finally, he calmed down a little bit. They thought they had it in pretty good shape. My dad finally went to the town. They let him go to town, and he immediately got a ride to the shipyard, come to United States. And it went to Galveston. It was clear across the country. And he finally got back to Fresno. First he went to Corcoran. Corcoran, he called it. Corcoran. And he wanted to be helping the farm. And he went for my mother later. And she came with my aunt. My sister was 6 years old. And that's how they did.
So just to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, the Germans were trying to conscript him into the German army. He said, I'm not fighting for them. And if he didn't take that stand, I mean, number one, you might never have been born because he could have been killed fighting in World War One. Number two, you might have been born over there and ended up on the other side of this war, huh? Have you ever thought about that, how different things might have been?
I didn't really get into that too bad. He did a lot of maneuvering. It seemed like he made the moves that he got where he wanted to go.
And so fast forward now, World War II, it's your senior year at Roosevelt High, and the principal says, hey, you guys are going to have to go fight now. We'll send you your diploma later. And you believed him, and you joined the Navy, and your dad says, I'm not standing in your way. But you were just 17 years old?
I was 16. I was a 16-year-old senior. My mom started me early. All along, they wondered why I was so young when I was trying to be a football player and all that, because I had a head start.
What were your expectations for the Navy? Did you have an idea in your mind of what it was going to be like?
I don't know if I did, but the Navy looked good to me. I just thought, look, these ships are nice and all that. I could go in there. I worked on tractors and things, and they asked me what I wanted to get into, and I said, well, I wanted to be a gunner's mate. They had a song in those days, down went the gunner and the gunner's mate, and I said, I'm going to be a gunner.
Did you have an idea of what kind of ship you wanted to serve on?
A destroyer, yeah. That name sounds good to me, a destroyer. We're in war. I'll take that on.
Did you know what a destroyer's purpose was, though?
Yes, I did. I knew that they were smaller than the big battleships, but they were the Greyhounds of the Pacific. That's what they called them. And tin cans, because they weren't heavily armored. They're little thin, and they were fast.
They were also on the outer lines of defense. I mean, you're there to protect the bigger ships, which means you're pretty expendable in the Navy's eyes, right?
That's right. The aircraft carriers had to be taken care of. We chose the air, and the Japanese chose to use the shells, and they were wrong. They made a mistake.
And your destroyer, the Wedderburn, DD-684, what was your introduction to the Wedderburn? What was your first impression on that ship?
Well, it wasn't quite ready to go to overseas. We were finishing cleaning the guns, getting them ready before we could go overseas. And one day it came time, we went through all that stuff, and we went under the Golden Gate, seasick. And we all got seasick. And I thought, this is a heck of a life. And I heard one of the officers talk to another one, and he says, we really had a good one to test the boys on, didn't we? So it was rougher than normal.
Well, and that makes you a plank owner, right? You're part of the original crew?
Yes, I was, plank owner. And I wasn't in the Navy Reserve. I was in the USN. They had a different, the reserves had put the R. It was a kind of an honor to be a USN.
And what was your duty? What were your assignments aboard the ship?
It was to take care of that gun. I was a gun captain. And I was responsible. I had, let's see, there was about six of us in the turret and some below the turret to put the ammunition up above. Everything had to click. They inspected it a lot, and we expected it. And if you were out of line, they would let you know it in front of a group. I mean, people. I ain't going to do that. And that's how that turned. When you go to a destroyer, that's your home. And nobody insults your home. You have everything neat, so you look good. Clean, no rust, no sleeping on the job, and don't try to outsmart everybody. They had all of that in there.
And you told us you were a gun captain, but you didn't say what kind of gun. What kind of gun was that?
5-inch, 38. The bore's 5 inches at 38 caliber is the length of the barrel. So that's it had two names.
And I know, you know, we don't have a sound effect here, but I'm wondering if you can describe or help us understand what it sounds like and feels like when that gun fires.
It's kind of scary. It's noisy, and it's a new thing in your life. When you go to that gun range, they start shooting this thing, and you got a fuse setter, and you got all different things in there, and they have to master their part. And I had to see that they did.
And I guess I should ask you this. I mean, we're talking about firing a gun that can do a lot of damage. But there's going to be other things that are flying your way. So when you said goodbye to your family and you headed overseas on that ship, did you think you were going to come back and see him again, or did you have your doubts?
There's a certain amount of attention in the Navy, on the water and all, but seemed like things went good for me. I thought I'd get back. Hope they would.
And now we know he did. But you haven't heard what he had to make it through just yet. Stan Filgus, just a teenager then, was part of the original crew of the destroyer USS Wedderburn, which would accumulate 7 battle stars during World War II. Find photos of Stan and his ship at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with a tin can sailor from World War II, Stan Filgus, 93 years old, of Fresno, California, part of the original crew of the destroyer USS Wedderburn. The son of immigrants from what was known then as Czechoslovakia, Stanley was one of two brothers to serve in our armed forces during World War II. His older brother, Albert, served in the Army Air Corps, and after getting treated for a serious neck injury, Al was paraded around from one hospital to another playing ping pong to demonstrate that one could sufficiently recover from that kind of injury. Stan would suffer an injury aboard his ship, but not in the manner you would likely imagine. We'll get to that eventually, but let's talk about that brand new destroyer's first taste of combat. This is July 1944. Stan Filgus is 18 years old. The initial assault on Guam has just taken place, and the Wedderburn would spend the next 3 weeks there protecting the invasion forces.
Was it Guam? Yeah. I got there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they had flares coming down on parachutes so that the lines at night would interchange, and I couldn't understand what that was till they said the lines probably stop and the fight starts in the dawn. That's how that worked out. Everybody had a little different idea of how it went. I did the best I could to make it work.
Well, and I know we'll hear some specific instances, but just tell me, generally speaking, when General Quarters sounds, what do you have to do? And how long do you have to keep doing it?
I have to go to the gun and pick up my helmet and the radio part and stand by until they say fire. That gun had a tray, and you put the powder in first, 28 pounds, and then the projectile's 54 pounds, and he puts it in, and he rams the firing pin, and it shoots.
And what was your specific role on that gun crew?
At that time, I had to see that everything was what it should be. I was responsible to the other people that it is right, it will fire, and it's nice and oiled and all that stuff. I had to watch for that. I had a good crew.
And you mentioned, you know, putting on the headset so you had radio communication. What are you hearing there? What kind of communication is taking place?
Well, you tell them it's ready, you're ready, and all that. They said, stand by, and they wait for that fire signal.
And you've got other guys who are responsible for aiming it, raising it, lowering it, left to right?
The trainer and a pointer, and they manipulate their calculations to hit something.
So this is a lot of people working together. It takes teamwork. And you were in charge of that team on that gun?
Well, the teamwork, sure. Each gun was proud of how their gun looked. They were very well taken care of because our lives depend on it. And you don't want it not to work.
What was the most challenging thing for you on that ship with all the time you spent on her?
To have to deal with the movement of the ship, there was always a little bit of tension because you never know when there's a mine in the water or something like that. You get used to that, though, that way of life, that you've got a ship that's your home and you better do the best you can with it.
Well, I know there was plenty that you witnessed, whether it was stuff heading for your ship or what happened to ships around you. What are some of those things that you saw and experienced that underscored the stakes of this war?
The first thing we saw was that the Japanese were going to be a real, real tough fight.
And you knew lives would be lost, but most people I talk to never think it's going to be them. I understand, though, you had a situation when an ammunition ship exploded very close to you, and it sounds like that kind of underscored the gravity of the situation and the danger of this duty you were carrying out for our country.
By Ulysses, that would be there. I was going to church. I got off the boat and put my foot inside, and that thing exploded. They torpedoed it with a one-man torpedo thing, and it got in there, and it did get a hit. And I thought, wow, it was an ammunition ship that it hit, which was full of ammunition. And it made a terrible sight. And like I said, the priest said, "Fellas, you know what happened right now?" He says, "Be right. Take care of yourself, because things like that happen."
So he took that opportunity with this tragedy happening right next to you to say, hey, you could be gone tomorrow. Make sure what you're doing today is what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Be ready. That's kind of tough to listen to, but that was what he said.
And the fact that you're telling me that story kind of makes it sound like that made a strong impression on you.
It did. It sure did. And I had a couple of times where someone took our hit, took the one that could have got us, get them. You see one get blown up, they guess you. I remember one of the ships ran into a mine at night, which they're floating, and wow. So even it's dark, those mines are floating around, and you say, geez, what if we hit one of those things? So there's always a chance that things aren't going to be perfect, and you have to try to make them perfect. And I ended up sleeping in my gun turret with a life jacket and a blanket, and I didn't have to keep running to the ship. I was there. Gun four is ready. Mandan's ready. And a gunnery guy said, fine. When that bell goes off, it's got the sound of its own. They can't copy that sound. You got to spine jiggles a little bit, but that goner, you wonder what the hell's going to happen.
Had you seen other guys do that, or was that your own idea to sleep in the gun turret?
Well, that was my idea because my bunk was in the dining room, and I had a top bunk, and wiring was right above me, and I looked at that, and I looked at the hatches to go in and out and all that. I looked at that, and I said, I will get out of here. There's too many guys here, and they takes time to get through to go. So I thought, I'm going to go where I'm right there. I should be closer to that gun. It was a steel floor. I got by all right with it, but that was important to me, that to be in that gun, because they called general quarters quite often.
Were you concerned that you wouldn't be able to get out of where your bunk was if your ship were hit?
I thought I wouldn't get out of there. I said I didn't like that at all, that crappy everything with bunks that are hanging here and there. So I went in the gun and I stayed there.
I can't imagine that a 5-inch 38 gun turret is a very comfortable sleeping arrangement.
Well, in those days, it was just fine with me. It didn't bother me to sleep on the deck. That helped me be ready instantly instead of going through these doors to try to get there. The bakery was up ahead of us. When they baked, they would bring me some goodies.
The bakers would bring you goodies because they knew you were sleeping up there?
Well, yeah. We manned the gun. I had the cooks and bakers, and they knew me from that. They're not baking when we're fighting. I got to know them pretty good.
So some of those cooks and bakers, when General Quarters sounded, they would have a role on your gun crew?
Yeah.
Well, I know we're going to talk about kamikazes in 1945, but there's something else that happened before that, and your ship was one of many that were touched by this. In fact, there were three destroyers that sank in the famous Typhoon Cobra or Halsey's Typhoon. Now, that would have been right after your 19th birthday, and this is another not-so-pleasant birthday present. What do you remember about that typhoon and how you guys experienced it aboard the Wedderburn?
Well, the sea got real rough, and the captain got on this communications, and he said, this destroyer is built to take a big wave turnover. Our captain did a good thing. We had our fuel tanks emptied to take fuel, and he re-ballasted that, which gave us the ability to maneuver. And those that did, the three that sunk, didn't re-ballast with salt water. They just took the ocean what it wanted. The best thing that happened to us was our captain re-ballast. And when the ship caught on a wind holding you way up there, that ballast would bring us down to where we could come back.
Tell me about how you experienced the typhoon. Where were you on the ship, and what did it do to you?
Well, the first place, we were down below decks because of the turmoil up above. It got very concerning to us. Is this thing going to turn off or turn over? And with that captain doing what he did, it really helped us a lot.
Were you holding on to something?
We were, well, you couldn't walk good. It was an uncomfortable, terrible typhoon. They lost 790 men in that one instant, which was a major, major setback.
Well, and I always wonder, when you're experiencing that, when you're below deck, you can't see what the water's doing, but you're feeling every move it makes, and you have no idea how long it's going to last. What do? Are you thinking about something? Are you imagining a better day or calmer seas? Are you saying a prayer? What are you doing?
Well, the thought was, how much can this thing take? And it turned out that it was done right by re-ballasting.
And I don't know if this is a fair question or one that you can answer, but it just makes me wonder, on a fear scale, on a scariness scale, compared to having a kamikaze flying at you, which you did, or enemy artillery firing at you, which you did, where does that typhoon rank? Was it as scary as those other situations?
Yes, it was. A lot of doubt was there. We were hoping that they'd make the right decisions. So the typhoon was a tough situation. We lost a lot of men there.
Yes, nearly 800 American lives lost between those three capsized destroyers, the Hull, the Monahan, and the Spence. Dozens of other ships were damaged by Typhoon Cobra 75 years ago this December, the exact same time in which the Battle of the Bulge was unfolding in Europe. If you dig back in the archives at hometownheroesradio.com, look for an interview with Pat Doohan, who later on would become a friend, thanks to Honor Flight, of our guest today, Stan Filgus. Mr. Doohan was one of 62 sailors to escape from the destroyer USS Hull as it went under in that typhoon. As for that 18-year-old former high school football star and champion sprinter, Stan Filgus, he would have kamikazes to dodge as the war raged on. We'll hear what he has to say about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Stan Filgus, 93 years old, of Fresno, California. He won't turn 94 until Pearl Harbor Day. It was his 16th birthday when Japan's surprise attack occurred. Before he was 17, he had already enlisted in the Navy, leaving Fresno's Roosevelt High School, where he'd been a section champion in football and a star in the 100 and 200 meters on the track, before he had the chance to graduate with the class of 1943. They told him they'd mail him a diploma. But it would take, believe it or not, 70 years before he received that. He did receive quite an education at sea on the destroyer USS Wedderburn, which earned 7 battle stars in the Pacific. We're going to hear about a close call with a kamikaze in a moment. But first, let's hear about the only injury he sustained aboard the Wedderburn. Believe it or not, it had nothing to do with combat.
At the indoctrination speech, we were standing, and officer came in and he said, "Sit down," and the guy behind me pulled a chair out. My tailbone hit the spine, like, left a lump. That was a real struggle to get rid of that, because the lump would swell up, they'd slash it, and it would not heal. I had that about 4 times. And finally, they discharged me. They sent me to Oak Knoll Naval Hospital. This guy I had was a specialist. That was his specialty. The rear end admiral, they called him. But he did fix it. That wasn't a real painful thing, but it was a nuisance. That foolishness of that guy pulling that chair, they sounded like it was nothing, but I could have wrung his neck every time I had trouble with that.
That's what I was going to ask. What'd you do to the guy who pulled the chair out from under you?
Well, they all laughed like hell and ha ha ha. It left a knob right on the spine.
Do you remember when you first understood what a kamikaze was, or this was something that you guys had to worry about and deal with?
Oh, when that came up, one of the Japanese hit a cruiser. It did a tremendous damage to it. They said that the guy flew it on purpose. That's the start of the kamikaze. He says, "What the hell kind of people are these? They'll fly into you. When are they going to stop that stuff? And how?" And it did. It was a big factor. That wasn't a joke. When they fly into you, that you do everything you can to not let them hit you.
Was it at Okinawa, maybe, where you told me you thought a kamikaze was coming straight down at your ship?
Yeah, that was Okinawa. It was in the evening. We'd heard reports of ships being run into kamikaze. We were on a radar picket. The radio man said, "Boy, we've been lucky today. They really hit those destroyers. Really? Man, we've been lucky today." And no sooner did that happen, when 2 planes came from Okinawa, fast planes. They were Georges. They named them after people, George. And they were fast. And the people that were protecting us there were making figure eights. So they sent the 4 planes after the 2. And on the other end of it, another blip comes up on the dang thing. And it's a plane. We opened fire on it, and it just kept coming, and it didn't take very long, and it was there. So he went to his dive, and our captain knew that on a vertical target, at a certain point, he can't change. He got to that point. The captain maneuvered it to where he couldn't change the dive part. Horizontal, those are worse. So he was going to miss us, and he made that run at it. It was crucial.
And where were you while that was happening?
In the gun. It looked like it was going to hit us, and I was scared. And it didn't hit, and I took a couple steps to get out of the gun, and my knee buckled. So I thought, chicken. Scary cat. So I went to my friend Tommy in the next gun. I said, "Tommy, were you scared?" He said, "He looked like he was coming down my barrel. He says, anybody tells you they're not afraid is a liar. So that helped me.
You felt a little better about being weak in the knees?
Yeah, that I was a chicken after all. It looked like I was the end of the world. And we never saw that plane after that trial to come back and try again. We never saw it.
So he was diving. The two planes coming in have been chased off by the four American planes protecting the fleet. Yeah. But then this other plane came in. He was diving on you, but because the ship moved, he had to pull up and take off.
That's what happened. He realized he was going to miss, and he, right off the water, he started gaining altitude. That's where that last time we saw it. All of us thought he was going to be successful, but our captain did a great job. He was an Airedale. You know what an Airedale is? And a blimp man. And we got him from the East Coast. And our first captain had a kind of a nervous breakdown, and he couldn't function good. So they got that blimp guy, and he knew what he was doing when he time to make his move. They wouldn't hit us. It was a close call. When you have a dangerous situation, it keeps you wondering sometimes, how about me?
What do you think would have happened to you if your captain didn't do that?
Well, kamikaze guy is very dangerous. So strong for the country that is something to be concerned about.
Because he can drop a bomb, for one, and then his plane's going to explode. There could be secondary explosions. Do you think you'd still be here if your captain hadn't dodged him?
Well, that's a thought. And as time went on with us escaping that dive, we really looked out on that thing. When looking down that barrel, he looked like he was coming right in. That was a point in my life that, man, you got a, they called it the Rabbit's Foot Destroyer. And I was on it. They had the amount of miles we made in a danger area, and the planes we shot down, we were in a lot of those to be called a Rabbit's Foot Destroyer. That was a place where I escaped to situations, and we got through them. And you can only get so confident for so long. So we had a reputation of being lucky. We didn't lose a man, none. Of all these thousands of miles that have on paperwork, it was lucky.
Are there some other moments that you think back on and you say, boy, that could have been me? And there's some kids and grandkids and great-grandkids who wouldn't be here?
Yeah, well, in those air battles, it is on your mind that this is intense. And when they're going to fly into you, that's pretty serious. If they're going to fly their plane into you.
I saw another note about your ship that in May of 45, you had a pretty important admiral on your ship and had to take him from Guam to Okinawa.
Yeah.
Was there a buzz on the ship when Bull Halsey came aboard?
Oh, yeah. Bull Halsey was a fighter, no matter what. He made a mistake on following that typhoon, but he didn't do it on purpose, but he followed with the typhoon. They had a hearing about that. They exonerated him.
Yeah, and they also changed the way they did things, and they started a program to fly planes into typhoons to take measurements so they could predict the weather better so they wouldn't have another tragedy like that.
It was we're going this way, I think this. It was just following the storm.
Well, what was it? Was it a big deal to your crew to have him aboard your ship?
Yes, it was. They all liked Halsey. Halsey was, he had an attitude of, we got to keep going. We can't stop. We've got to work it out. When he got in charge of that task force, that was a good move.
You're out there for months and months and months. As time goes by, did you ever find yourself wondering, hey, is this ever going to end? What's going to happen here? Was there some uncertainty that you had to deal with?
We were making headway, but we had to make up time. We finally got to where we had enough planes to protect us. That's the way it went. They chose the battleships. We chose the air, and we were right. And when finally the war was over, the first thing I said, I made it. To myself, or out loud.
What kind of welcome did you have when you made it back to the States?
We were supposed to go to San Diego. On the way there, they changed it to Washington. We got there, welcome home sign was hanging in the water. They'd already had their time.
When you say hanging in the water, you mean it had been on display and now it had fallen and you couldn't even read it all?
Like hooked on a building on the dock.
Yeah.
And the thing was hanging down. They said they already celebrated. It was kind of like they don't even care. We made comment on that. What the hell? But that's the way it turned out.
What about getting back here to Fresno? What was that like to see your family again?
That was a relief. My mom was very relieved that I made it. The mothers are. And my dad was proud. We went on going from hardwood floors to carpet. And we made a carpet store. It was a relief to say that I made it. And when I went on that honor flight, that's the first thought that I had was, how come that I made it? Doing the same things these other guys are doing, and they got trouble.
Well, you're talking about the honor flight, and it's been a few years now, but you got to share that experience with your brother.
Yeah.
You both went on the flight, and you're saying that when you were there at the World War II Memorial,
yeah,
looking at the gold stars that represent 406,000 Americans who died in the war, that was the thought going through your mind? Why wasn't I one of those?
That's exactly right. I survived situations that were serious, and it didn't get me.
What was the best part of that honor flight experience for you?
The best part was the electricity of being there in that flight. Is not like taking a picture. It has electric to it. There's a certain feeling that you got there. I had on that flight, there was a guy in the plane, the seat next to us, and he wasn't a Navy man. He says, what's this Navy man destroyers, tin cans? And I explained it to him. I said, how do you know that? I says, because I am one of those special people. I told the way I thought about it, yeah, they are special. The destroyer men, they got the accolades for being what they were. They were the little boys that played big. That flight was really exceptional for me.
Well, and I don't want to forget to ask about this high school diploma, because your principal promised you, hey, you guys leave now, we'll mail you the diploma. How long did it take for the mail to get to you?
Someone brought it to me.
But it took a few years.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Like about 70 years?
A long time. And it was really a nice diploma. It said, once a writer, always a writer. It was a kind of a handmade diploma. It had everything nice. I got mine. My buddy Zach Carr didn't get one. He got killed.
Can you tell us who Zach Carr was?
Zach Carr was a bright guy. He was in the upper class of the school. Everybody liked Zach Carr. Everybody liked Zach Carr. He was just a guy that they liked. We lost him. It was a big jolt for us, especially the way he died. They actually executed him.
Yeah, what all do you know about where he was and what happened to him?
He was captured, and they were behind the lines. They shot him.
This was a long way from you. This is in Europe, the Battle of the Bulge. So he was captured by the Germans,
yeah,
and executed. And how did you hear about it?
A girl from the school went over there to get the whole story on it, of how it happened and why they took his life. But Zach was on the football team. He was bright. And the kind of guy that you could get along with. He got along with all of them.
Well, here it is 75 years later, and you're telling me about him. So that indicates to me that you've probably thought about him a fair amount over all those years.
Yeah, I always did. I've thought about him a lot because he was such a big player at Roosevelt. Yeah, I had the Nautilus, you know, the school book, Zach this, Zach that. He was the kind of guy you had to like. And it was such a shame that he got that predicament. It was a tremendous loss.
I'm not trying to put a thought in your head or words in your mouth, but I'm just curious, since you talked about being at the World War II Memorial and wondering, why not me? When you were there looking at all those gold stars, did you think about Zach?
Yeah, I sure did. I saw it at the Vietnam Memorial, all those people that are looking at the names. One guy was looking, and I heard someone say, "That here he is, here." They'd taken paper and they'd rub it on there. That means a lot. It was emotional for me, that trip was. I got to see all kinds of guys that did things. The veterans were proud of each other. Basically, we all felt like we really did something. So that's the way it is.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me some of your story. Is there something that you would say that you're most proud of?
That I was in there young, and I learned to do my job there, and I think I did good. And I'm proud of it even today. I see veterans. A lot of people say thanks. The flag represents our freedom and our country. That's humanity. It's amazing how your memory leaves you at times, but there's some things it don't. And my time in the service was very important to me. I was very proud of it. I thought I did a good job, and here I am.
Yep, still going and looking forward to his 94th birthday on December 7th. Stan and his wife Jean have been married for 62 years now, and they have 15 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren to occupy their attention. You'll find a short video of Stan online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. He shows us where he was on that destroyer, the USS Wedderburn. The photos you'll find there also include one of him as a baby-faced teenager. It's included in the Veterans Honor Wall at Nazareth House of Fresno, where Stan and Jean now live. And I can't conclude today without a word of gratitude for their nephew, Kerry, who passed away suddenly and unexpectedly in July. Kerry, a veteran himself, had accompanied his father and uncle to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight 5 years ago. He continued to volunteer for the organization after that, and for the last year or two, every time I saw Kerry, he spoke glowingly about his Uncle Stan. He said he was trying to twist his arm and get him to sit down with me and tell his story. So, Kerry, I'm sorry it took so long, but this one's for you, and we really miss you. That's our program for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.